The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
I'm Mike Consul.
And I'm Loretta Klodfelter.
Welcome to Inside the Edition. We are here to talk about the December 2017 edition, in particular two stories that Loretta wanted to highlight as editor of the magazine, one being the trends that are transforming the industrial sector, as well as the single-family rental class, emerging asset class, something we haven't visited in a long time. But let's start with industrial, Loretta. What about these trends in industrial real estate? And I guess this ties into e-commerce to some extent.
Almost completely tied into e-commerce. You know, there's been a lot of talk in the last year about the retail apocalypse that is facing retail investors. And the story in the industrial market is basically the flip side of that. You know, because we are starting to see this shift of buying goods online, you know, those goods need to be stored somewhere before they're delivered to your home, and that is these warehouses. And so what we take a look at in particular is this trend. You know, shopping online is nothing new. Getting the thing you bought right away is, and that's sort of the next step. That's the next game changer for online retail, because so much of buying something online involves this sort of this wait time, you know, this sort of delayed gratification that, you know, oh, well, I click buy, but it won't get here for, you know, a week or, you know, 2 days if I have Amazon Prime, you know, and now like 2 days with Amazon Prime is like, ugh, it's not here yet. So, you know, you're starting to see one-day delivery, same-day delivery in urban areas become possible. And part of what's happening now is this move toward smaller warehouses in urban infill locations. And that's a real shift in the industrial trend. What we saw in the last decade was this move toward really big warehouses, just these massive mega warehouses, these huge big boxes, a million square feet or more, that, you know, super high tech distribution centers, usually, you know, fairly far away from the central city, you know, in this sort of big open empty place where you can have a giant warehouse. Well, that was great when you were delivering everything 2, 3, 4, 5 days, but now that people want something right away, you need a warehouse right in the middle of the town. And these tend to be smaller and have a wider variety of goods. They need more human staffers. They need bigger parking lots. You know, it's just a completely different type of industrial. And if you look at where the growth has been in the last few years, we had some interesting data that showed that, you know, the net asking rents for light industrial have grown faster from 2014 to 2016 compared to big box warehouse, and the availability trends, the availability has fallen even more. Now, both of those are seeing rent growth and availability fall, but light industrial has just seen an even more so.
So more warehouses, bigger warehouses and smaller warehouses. I ran across this statistic yesterday from CBRE. The average size of a U.S. warehouse has expanded by 143% since 2012. But at the same time, like what you're talking about, Loretta, is that now we're getting smaller warehouses closer in for that same day delivery. I would imagine that some of these warehouses are in locations where they're paying a lot of attention to making them look somewhat aesthetically pleasing.
Maybe. I mean, it's I mean, we're still talking about warehouses here. I don't think anyone's been talking about, you know, making the warehouse look attractive so much as they are really focusing on making sure it has the right layout, the right clear heights, and the right sort of parking and other, you know, car and truck access. Because one of the interesting trends that we're seeing with this is, especially with same-day delivery, you know, who's making those deliveries? It's not necessarily the big brown truck. It's, you know, Uber has an instant delivery service. This is something that's highlighted in the article, that, you know, they use... You know, they use apps. It's Uber for delivery. It's just people in their cars with apps picking up a package, taking it to where it needs to go. Amazon has a thing. It's called Amazon Flex. You know, this is really kind of fascinating what we're seeing as these sort of new, and I guess you could call that a tech trend. It's a, you know, using apps to match delivery drivers with packages and with destinations. It's fascinating.
Mm. Now, a big part of this is also, in addition to our instant gratification, which is very American of us, there's also the competition with the brick-and-mortar stores, correct? Because I know I can go to a brick-and-mortar store and instantly gratify myself by buying it, taking it home. And now we have, what, Walmart, Target, Amazon in particular, I guess, saying, order it now, we'll have it to you this afternoon or this evening.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's this sort of, you know, instant fulfillment and delivery is really, this really is a threat to the brick and mortar store because, you know, the experience of going to a store and getting a thing and going home with that thing. Whatever it is that you're stopping to buy, you know, maybe you need some floss or something or shampoo, you know, that's not the kind of experiential retail experience that I need to have every so often. That's not going out to a nice restaurant, or, you know, having sort of a fun date night at the movie theater. That's going to the store, driving to the store, parking at the store, going into the store, buying some floss and some shampoo, getting home with that stuff. I mean, I needed the floss and the shampoo. I needed it right away. I couldn't wait 4 days for it to be delivered. But it's not like I enjoyed the experience of going to the pharmacy. Now I can just, you know, call it up on my mobile phone and have it brought straight to wherever I'm at, and I get it right away. I mean, that is deeply threatening. To the more traditional.
Sure. You don't have to
the more traditional.
It's just, you know, just this is my, I'm using Colgate or Arm & Hammer toothpaste. Just send it over every 4 weeks or whatever my cycle is, or I just hit the button and order it. But when it comes to something like clothing, what I would like to see, if Amazon is listening, I would like to see, and all of you other retailers out there.
Let's just say this podcast is widely listened by Amazon, so they will be taking you up on this at the very moment, yes.
All right, well, Jeff Bezos, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What I want is for a delivery to be made. If it's clothing, I want a chance to try it on and send it back right away if it doesn't fit with instructions for the new size. That would be pretty good. Now, I don't buy clothes online very often.
I was like, I do buy clothes online. You could totally do that.
Okay, there you go. Now, let's...
In fact, the next step on buying clothes online is actually another thing that I think we should, you know, retailers need to keep an eye on is the delivery box concept, where people get a box every month, the subscription box. People are really into the subscription box. You get a box, it's full of clothes or toiletries or makeup or whatever you've subscribed to. And every month you get a box of new things.
And this is the stuff that they're anticipating. They know from your buying habits and your predilections, we're going to send you a box of stuff that you're going to like, we think you're going to like, and you send back what you don't like. Is that how it works?
Usually with the clothing, there is a send back what you don't like. Usually with like the makeup boxes, you just end up with lipstick that doesn't match your skin color. But
You can always re-gift, I guess.
You can always do that. But, you know, I think what all of this is, what all of this ties into is this idea that ordering online and having things delivered to you has become normalized. And the more normalized that is, you know, the more we're going to need warehouses of all different sizes and in all different locations to meet these needs. Like, that's really the bottom line here, is that the more normalized this sort of experience gets, the more we're going to need industrial property. And that is why industrial property has been, you know, far and away the best performer over the last couple of years. You know, it's quite amazing, actually, to see the kind of performance that you're seeing in the logistics section. You know, just as sort of a thing to keep an eye on, if you look at, you know, the REIT market, for instance, REITs in general have just been sort of bouncing along for the last year, but industrial REITs are well outperforming the larger sector. Yes. As a whole.
Yes. And one of the questions I've got about this is whether this actually works out for Amazon and Target and the others with the smaller warehouse. Now you're talking about a lot of more locations than they used to have, and that's a lot of extra space that you're leasing closer in to make these same day deliveries. Obviously the economics must work out, but are they sacrificing anything in terms of profit margin, or does this allow them to shrink the bigger warehouses that are out in the country?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. The fascinating thing about Amazon, you know, is talking about their profit margin, they're not a wildly profitable company. You know, they operate on the sort of razor thin margins of the rest of the retail sector. You know, and so you're not necessarily seeing the kind of huge cash revenues that you see, or I mean, not revenues, but profits that you see if you look at, you know, sort of an Apple or a Google parent Alphabet sort of company. You know, Amazon definitely, they operate pretty close to the red, just because that's the industry that they're trying to build, and yeah, really, you know, focusing on those lower prices. So I actually don't know if they're seeing a whole lot of profit from their warehouse decisions. You know, they're huge though. They're adding 15 million square feet of warehouse space a year. It's just staggering.
That is staggering. Now the thing when you're dealing with retail products, the margins are usually not good, but the thing with Amazon is where they really make their money is with Amazon Web Services, their cloud computing division, which takes up more warehouse space yet.
Yeah, and I, you know, that's the data center side of their business, and you know, they build and operate their own data centers, but you know, many of their competitors will lease data center, and that is another really emerging property investment class. I don't think anyone was talking about data centers 10 years ago, and now.
We were talking about it just last month or the month before, and we're on top of it. We're on top of it. We didn't predict it, but we are certainly tracking it.
But, you know, this is really the sort of thing that, you know, the real estate asset class is not static, and the core, you know, we talk about sometimes the four food groups. Back in the early days, in the late 80s, for instance, there were not four food groups. There were only three: retail, industrial, and office. Apartments weren't even considered a core property type. Now they're, you know, the corest of the core. And so, and this is me transitioning right now, just to, you know, be very transparent, to another story we have in this issue about single family rentals, which is very much an emerging asset class, but we are beginning to see institutional investment in, you know, large portfolios of single family homes that instead of for sale, which has long been, there's long been institutional investment in the for sale category, in the home building category. But this buy and hold strategy for single family homes is really a reaction that, you know, it's really as an institutional class has grown out of the the global financial crisis, the Great Recession of 10 years ago now.
Yeah, and now the whole thing was a lot of people said this is never going to work because you're going to have these scattered households. But from what I can tell, Loretta, they tended to buy up a lot of households in a common area, close together, maybe a contiguous subdivisions, which would mean that when it comes to the maintenance, which is the big issue, or at least one of the big issues, their team of fix-it people can actually hit a lot of different properties at once. They're not driving all over Phoenix, Arizona to get this done. They're clustering these homes in certain areas, is my understanding. And it's actually, the numbers I've seen on this, but it's been a while, it sounds like it's been working out fairly well. It's not ready to be the fifth food group yet. I'm pretty sure that nobody's declared it a true asset class for institutional investors. But what are the numbers saying in terms of how they're performing?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely still a niche strategy, for sure. But it is an emerging strategy, you know, and I think it can at the very least be named along with senior housing, student housing, self-storage, and many of the other sort of medical office and many of the other sort of niche plays that have grown up. I think single family rental is another of these sort of niche plays that are quite interesting. What the article looks at is it takes a look at county record and transaction data. So it's an opportunity to sort of dive into who's been buying these single family homes and what sort of strategy is being used with their investment. And what the paper, because this is a sort of an excerpt of a white paper, what the paper found, what the research finds, is that there's, broadly speaking, three different institutional investment strategies if you're looking at the single family home market. And so what you're finding is the REITs in particular, because there are now, you know, a number of public REITs in this sector. They tend to be targeting sort of the upper end, the premium section of the market. So they're focusing on homes that are larger and more expensive compared to the other institutional investments. And they're looking at, higher income zip codes and homes that are newer. And so that, you know, and of course all of those things are going to fit together, that the newer homes in the higher income zip codes will also be the more expensive and larger homes. But that is, you know, on these two different measurements, that is where the public REITs have sort of found their place. Whereas...
Is the strategy to operate and have cash flow continuously? Or are they thinking in terms of at some point we will have a liquidity event, we'll sell the whole package off to another investor?
I think that is definitely an exit strategy, but for the REITs in particular, I think there's definitely more of a holding for a longer, and so you do want the more premium properties. There's also a sort of a lower end home strategy, which is very much focused on yield, and these are buyers who are buying homes, you know, for less than $100,000. These are smaller, older homes in less wealthy neighborhoods, you know, and that's where you're really just going for sort of the high gross rent yields, and that's really the strategy. It's maximum yield, but again, it's just sort of a different zone. And then there's sort of a third strategy, a third group of investors who have sort of found a place in between to do that sort of a mid-level, you know, slightly more expensive homes in larger, wealthier neighborhoods. And so these are sort of just the different ways that institutions are getting into it. You know, they estimate, the other thing is this is so small compared to the number of homes in general. You know, they estimate that institutional ownership of multifamily is about 50% of the multifamily market. But institutional ownership of single-family rentals is maybe 2% of the overall market. So, you know, the opportunity here is quite large if this sort of trend grows. And I think there are some real advantages for renters to work with these more institutional landlords. There are advantages of working with a landlord who, you know, has experience and is sort of plugged into a network of repair, is much more likely to know and follow local laws regarding real estate. You know, some of these sort of more mom and pop landlords might skate by along the legality of certain things, and I think that can at some points be sort of detrimental for tenants. So I think growing institutionalization in this market is a net positive for renters, although, you know, it may come with sort of driving rents up, but I think the overall benefits do outweigh that, as you do get what you pay for in that case.
Have the rents escalated as these property values have gone up? I mean, normally a company or an institution that owns an apartment complex, let's say, just automatically raises the rent every year. It's like clockwork. But, you know, these single-family rentals, depending on where they're located, and they've all been located in good markets or they wouldn't have made the move, I'm thinking that the value has gone up substantially since they bought them for a song after the great, what do we call it? We don't call it the Great Recession. We call it the global financial crisis. And have rents escalated a great deal? Do you have any statistics on that, or is that closely held to the vest?
These companies are holding that information pretty closely. Like the research, we can know, you know, because of you know what's put out there, we can know transaction data. We can know the size of the home. We can know the age of the home. We can know the price paid for the home, but we don't then know necessarily what they're renting out the home for and how quickly those rents have gone up. And because it is such a small segment, there really isn't the same level of sort of tracking and data that you're going to see with other property types. Although there is some belief that the cap rates are higher for the sort of value buyers or the lower end home buyers than for the sort of premium properties that are owned by the public REITs.
So we had several companies, of course, jump in years ago after the, you know, the global financial crisis, the housing collapse. Are we still seeing players coming into this space, or is it kind of a wait and see approach at this point, Loretta?
What we've really seen, I mean, I think there are new entrants into the market, but there's also been a pretty dramatic amount of consolidation in the market in the last couple of years. So, you know, for instance, you've got someone like Colony Starwood Homes, which was itself, I believe, a merger between Starwood and Colony, two separate REITs focusing on the home section. Colony Starwood then bought a big, you know, a big portfolio of homes from Waypoint Homes, changed its name to Starwood Waypoint Homes. And now, just in August, Starwood Waypoint Homes announced plans to merge with Invitation Homes, which is itself pretty much owned by Blackstone. And so really what we're seeing is sort of at this sort of, you know, some of these biggest players are just getting bigger as they merge together.
Interesting. Well, you know, when a company like Blackstone's in the space and Starwood and I believe Apollo's in that space, these are not people who make those kind of commitments lightly, even if they're relatively small commitments. But it certainly says something about what they see as the potential there.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, we've really seen an institutionalization happen. You know, big institutional players have entered the market in the last decade, and you know, they've definitely been putting together large portfolios and then merging to consolidate those portfolios even more. So I do think that the consolidation is one of the big trends in the space over the last year.
Looking forward to January, Loretta. What do you have anything you can tease readers with for the January edition that you're working on?
Well, I'm working on a big piece that takes a look at 2018 and sort of what's our outlook for the year. I can say that barring any unforeseen events, which are unforeseen in that we cannot foresee them, 2018 looks to be fairly similar to 2017. It is, I think a lot of people are expecting a more of the same sort of year, with this sort of, you know, economic growth. We're seeing, you know, as long as nothing goes wrong. And I mean, that is, it can't be overstated. There are many things that could go wrong. Mm. But if they don't, then it's not going to change. I mean, it's hard for that to be my forecast, which is it's going to be the same unless it's different.
Well, that's a pretty safe bet.
No one ever lost money betting on same or different.
Yes. We look forward to the January edition then, Loretta. And it's about to be a new year, exciting times. We will check back with you in about 30 days.
Yeah. Happy holidays and a happy new year.